it quickly disappears, right? It's like turning on a light switch almost at a certain point. But it is a challenge, to your point. It's definitely a challenge. And I think the industry as a whole, I don't know that the industry does a good job of countering, you know, that. If anything, I think it's the opposite, because you see, and not the running industry, but the, I would say the fitness industry more, really pushing the narrative of like, how many calories can you burn in the least amount of time, as many days a week as possible. And enough people see that and they think that that is what they need to do for the rest of their life. And it's like, it's not going to work. I mean, something's, you know, going to take you out of that.
Hey, welcome back to the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast, where we talk about what it takes to go the distance in running and in life. I'm your host, Eric Dieter. I'm an ultramarathon runner and a mindset coach. When trail runners get together to run a few miles, we never know where the conversation is going to go. So if you're ready, let's get started. My guest this week is Ben Rial. Ben is a certified personal trainer and a certified nutrition coach. He works to help his clients develop the mindset for healthy habits for both fitness and nutrition. Ben has a background as a licensed attorney in the state of Georgia, and he served as an officer in the United States Marine Corps. He is also an ultramarathon runner. He has good advice about nutrition and mindset for all of us runners going, whether you're any distance you run. He's got some good things to say. Hope you enjoy my conversation with Ben Rial. And I just give you my perspective. So,
yeah, no, it's great. It's a cool conversation.
That's cool. Well, tell me a little bit about who you are. And you got, I know you're a little bit in athletics and nutrition. And you had also served in the military. So how did you get started in athletics?
Yeah, so it's kind of been a long progression from almost, you know, recreational nature, which I think is where most people start in some form or fashion. As far as running, I ran cross country in high school. And so I did, you know, all 4 years of high school. And that was probably, you know, at the time the passion wasn't developed. It was more of like an obligatory extracurricular, that I had some success with, but didn't truly really love running. And then got into college and went to college, really didn't pursue any kind of physical fitness or a whole lot for the first couple of years, which is not surprising. But towards the latter part of my college career, like the last couple of years, is when I started really just pursuing fitness again in terms of, recreation, feeling good, looking good, that type of thing. And that kind of reinvigorated my passion for running, because that was kind of a staple for what I was doing. I was doing weight training as well, but you always fall back on what you're really comfortable in. And so I picked up running again and took off with that, and was not doing any races or anything really until after college, is when I kind of started to explore more longer distance running, like half marathons and things like that. After college, I went down to law school in Miami, Florida. That was in 2008. And I ran my second half down there. I was continuing to run, and that was really the primary running at that point was just a stress reliever and something that, you know, was enjoyable, but maybe pick up some races here or there. So I did a half down there. And then I think it was during a career fair, actually my first year in law school is when I spoke to the Marine Corps recruiters. They had, all kinds of different employers, traditional law firm related, and then a lot of federal law enforcement agencies and some military service there. So spoke with the Marine Corps, and that was really transitional in terms of taking recreational fitness and then putting a specific intent on it. So in terms of guiding what I was doing and why I was doing it, And everything then became geared towards getting selected to go to OCS and ultimately go into the Marine Corps. And so running became much more, I'd say, specific in nature in terms of, you know, what I was doing, because I was just prepping for this physical fitness test. One of the events is a 3 mile run. So really training for that. And kind of during that time period, I had a knee surgery. This is while I was in law school. Had a knee surgery and have always had issues with like shin splints and things like that. Mm-hmm. The knee surgery was interesting because I was going, you know, kind of 100 miles an hour as far as building training, and then just had some issues with my knee joint. So they basically just cleaned it out and got a little bit of PT, but it took a lot longer to recover from that than kind of anticipated. And I think that's an interesting part of the story, because it's like I was basically brought back to day one.
Okay.
That took about a year off and had gone to see different surgeons, saw different physical therapists. And, you know, through the nature of, it was just a basic arthroscopy, you know, surgery, mm-hmm. like nothing crazy. They thought it made it, maybe it was a meniscus tear. It wasn't. And they discovered that through the surgery. But point of the story being, they went through three portals. So, to get into the knee. And, one of those was right through the quad. And, you know, as a result, I lost a lot of knee stability just at mm-hmm. the basic level. And then my quad atrophied quite a bit. And I didn't do any physical therapy initially. I just jumped back into what I was doing previously. And that was what I was told, hey, you'll be fine. And I was not fine.
Oh, really? So the doctors just said that the surgery is fine. You just start running again. And
he said, you're in good enough shape. You'll just be able to get back into it. And that's what I did. And it was excruciatingly painful, because with every step you would take, or in running, you know, with every step you take forward, my knee was not stable. And so I was having a whole lot of pain in the front of the knee that I had never experienced before. And yeah, so I spent basically, this was my second year in law school, spent that year really focused on like, how do I get my knee back? My ultimate goal is to go into the Marine Corps, mm-hmm. but how do I get my knee back so that I can just start running again? And that, yeah.
So did that delay the surgery and your recovery delay your entry into the Marine Corps?
So, it's a good question. I don't think that in hindsight, I don't think that it did, because I ultimately didn't get selected until, I had to get through law school, and then, and then I ended up passing the bar. Now, during my first year, I thought that I would be able to go attend, officer candidate school during the summer. Between my first and second year law school, I realized that that was not going to be an option, specifically because I was a lawyer. So as a grad student, that's typically a program that kids going through college are able to enter into. They hadn't done that with somebody in law school. So what that meant then was probably I wasn't going to be able to get selected to until after law school. So it gave me a little bit of a buffer, but during this entire time, I'm still just trying to stay in the mix. Right. Yeah. And it's really hard because a lot of the things you can't do. So a lot of pressure just to get back to just even no pain. I wasn't even worried about the time, the actual run times, right. At this point. And that period was, you know, one of a lot of growth, in terms of, you know, setting conditions for a physical goal. Mm-hmm. And you know, that really, I think, started the fascination and the intrigue with, at the very basic level, program design and putting together a fitness program or physical fitness, you know, regimen that is progressive in nature and building towards a longer term goal. Whereas prior to, I think I had been in the mindset of, you just go really hard as much as you can, and that doesn't work. And for a lot of people, myself included, you kind of have to be hit with that reality before it really sinks in. And so that led then, you know, really in a lot of ways to what I'm doing today is in terms of program design. But, you know, but during that time period, I was trying everything. I went through, you know, a barefoot running phase, you know, where I was doing this on the grass, and that was a short-lived phase. You know, because I'm trying to figure out, okay, is it, you know, how do I, what do I need to do for my knees? Is it my running gait? Is it my foot strike? Is it, you know, all these things? And
so I'm curious what you found with barefoot running. You said you tried it for a while. What was your...
I'll tell you what I found, Eric. I found a lot of plantar fasciitis.
Really?
Yeah. That was an interesting experiment. And you know, read a bunch of books on it and bought those five finger shoes. I was one of those guys with the five finger shoes. You know, I'm going out into the grass fields, you know, and trying to be progressive with it. But it,
you ran primarily on grass then?
I was running on grass then when I was trying to kind of, you know, ease into this phase. And there was an element of foot strike, you know, that was involved because I've notoriously been in the past a really big heel striker. Mm-hmm. So I knew that was one of the things that I needed to fix, not just for my knee, but for more efficient running form. But maybe not the proper way to go about it. This was when I was back in Atlanta after law school. I hired a running coach and did a lot of film with my running gait and form and everything like that. That was the proper way to do it. And I learned a great deal from that experience. But ultimately, the long and short of it is we got through that phase and graduated from law school and then moved back to Georgia to take the state bar in Georgia and completed that. And then it was shortly after that that I was selected to attend OCS.
Okay.
And that was in 2013. And that kind of... you know, began my time in the Marine Corps.
So is OCS, they put you through the standard boot camp then in Marine Corps, or was it a little bit different?
It's a slightly different. The enlisted Marines, if you enlist in the Marine Corps and you go to boot camp, you either go to the West Coast in San Diego, or you go to Parris Island, in South Carolina. And, for those that are attending OCS that are ultimately going to become officers, they go to officer candidate school in Quantico, Virginia. So a little bit different. I think overall, just a different intent or a different, you know, end state with OCS versus boot camp. Mm-hmm. And you know, boot camp is really meant to break people down and then build them back up into Marines. And OCS is definitely. You know, it's definitely a crash course in the military and the Marine Corps, but it's really focused on screening you for leadership ability.
Okay.
And to be, you know, to ultimately become an officer. So they're not so much breaking you down as much as putting you under, you know, stressful situations and evaluating your ability to lead and make decisions. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, physical fitness is a big part of that, but so kind of a different experience. We don't go to boot camp, we go to OCS. And then after OCS, you go on to, what's called the basic school, which is a 6-month course, also in Quantico, to just kind of learn the very basics of, you know, kind of combat operations at the, junior officer level, you know, mm-hmm. At officer.
Okay. So then you went in as a lawyer. Was that kind of your focus then in the military law? Was that kind of what you were looking at?
Yeah. So when I first started talking to the recruiters, that's what I was interested in. I wanted to be a JAG officer, and I didn't know anything about JAG officers or what they did other than that show. You remember that show?
We watched it to the end, I think. I don't know if we didn't get it in on the very beginning, but we watched it to the end. So
Yeah. So that was, and that show makes it look like, oh man, this is awesome. Like the JAGs are doing all kinds of stuff. There doesn't show them like writing reports and, you know, doing everything that lawyers normally do. And so, you know, it's weird. Things work out for a reason, right? Because that was initially what I was trying to apply as during my first year working with a recruiter. And I think the more that I learned, the more that I realized I didn't want to, that just wasn't what I wanted to pursue, you know, in the Marine Corps. But I was, you know, done with my first year. The first year is the hardest year of law school. Mm-hmm. I was moving through my second year And I'm kind of like, well, I can't say today I have a contract to go in and do something else. So let's continue. Let's pursue this. Let's finish law school. Let's finish the bar exam. And then I went in on a ground contract. So the Marine Corps, when you go into the Marine Corps, to OCS, you either have a ground contract, an air contract, or a law contract. It's one of those three.
Okay.
Air is going to, it's for pilots, right? If you're going to fly anything, you're going to be on an air contract. If you're going to be a lawyer or a JAG, you're going to be on a law contract. And then every other MOS, not included in air or not included in aviation or law, falls underground. And ultimately, then you kind of at a certain point in training, you submit a wish list, kind of what you want. And they do the whole organizational gymnastics and put everybody in the class, they assign their different MOSs. Ultimately, I became a military police officer. So there was a lot of, obviously a lot of carryover with aspects of the law. Mm-hmm. It was a great opportunity. I got to learn a ton of stuff, and was not, so much restricted to just a legal setting. Just really got to do some cool stuff and be around some tremendous leaders and some people that were, really inspirational. During these formative times of like you're getting into the military, you're figuring out, you're learning how to lead, what works and what doesn't work, all these different things. So, didn't do law in the military. I just went on inactive status with my bar license. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which you can do. And then, pursued what I was doing in the Marine Corps and then ultimately, came back to Atlanta in 2015. I went in on a reserve contract. At the time, they were not giving any contracts to active duty slots, just with the way the budget was. So, I had volunteered for some opportunities, was able to stay on active duty as long as I could. And then ultimately, towards the end of 2015, was called back to the reserve unit, to fulfill a reserve obligation basically that I had, with them, which completed that by 2017. So that was kind of the 4-year stint broken up doing a lot of different things.
Yeah. Interesting. So was your time as a police officer, how did that form your view of the law? I mean, typically the portrayal of law enforcement versus the legal profession is an adversarial relationship. And so did it help you to see the other side of that?
It's interesting because, I don't know what the future of the military police corps is in, in the Marine Corps kind of moving forward. Just there's a lot of things changing obviously with, with defense, but, the cool thing while I was there was that there were so many different collateral duties would be one way to refer to them, just other opportunities that were not necessarily in a traditional law enforcement role where you are like that people think of when they see MPs, right, driving around in cruisers, handling domestic disputes and, DUIs and things like that. There is a certain portion of MPs that go and do that. And then at the time they had law enforcement battalions. So that was kind of a lot of the other MPs would go to the battalions and they were more training for, typical things that you would see overseas and that operational profile. Mm-hmm. And then it also afforded all of these other opportunities where, as an MP officer, and especially for me, I was a lot older at the time than a lot of my counterparts because I went in at 29. A lot of the guys were like, they were 22 or so. Mm-hmm. And with the law degree, it just ended up that I ended up having a lot of different jobs. Like I was handling, we had a training section, marksmanship training section, that I was officer in charge of. And then, was also helping with, kind of access control and, force protection, efforts and planning with our headquarters building, like just lots of random, and And again, I was there just volunteering. Like I was just trying to get experience. So it was like, I was just taking random, like whatever. I didn't care what it was, but it got me experience. And that resulted in me doing a lot of different things, some of which overlapped with kind of an anti-terrorism, you know, force protection mindset or capacity. And then some of them were just, you know, acting as officer in charge for, you know, a training section or, you know, we're doing different things in the ops section, more administrative in nature. But and then that ultimately got me to Japan on a deployment to Japan with security forces. And they kind of, again, there I was mainly in an administrative role, just working with kind of a headquarters unit of a deployed company. But it was all crisis response work and embassy reinforcement. So a lot of carryover with just general, again, like force protection, anti-terrorism type stuff. But very cool. So got to dip my hands in a lot of different things and experience a lot of things. But to answer your question, ironically, none of them were traditional law enforcement in nature.
Really. Okay.
And that just was kind of the luck of the draw. You know, people just end up doing that or end up doing something else.
Yeah. So you got through your military and you're a lawyer, but you're also got kind of into the nutrition area as well. I mean, it's because you're working right now at doing, you know, fitness and nutrition as a coach. So how did that come about?
Yeah. So the kind of when I got out of the military, I was really seeking an opportunity in fitness in some form or fashion. Like it was that generic. It was that open-ended. We did a lot of that in the Marine Corps, obviously. I got an opportunity to mentor a lot of Marines and, you know, have an impact from a leadership standpoint. So I knew I wanted to do something in that realm. And coaching and training people was ultimately what made sense to me. So I started doing personal training and group fitness in 2016. It was 2016. Small gym in Midtown Atlanta that had just opened up. And so we were doing classes during the day, you know, personal training and all that stuff. And I got my feet wet for about a year and a half with that. And then really started pursuing like additional opportunities for, you know, just additional tools for my toolbox. And one of them was nutrition. Mm-hmm. So that was 2018, went through the precision nutrition course. What I realized was I was doing so much just fitness oriented coaching and training and recognized that, you know, I needed a nutrition capability. Like that was, you know, and to be able to provide that to clients to maximize whatever we're doing fitness wise. And so pursued that and started doing the nutrition coaching as well as the training, and then did that for, that was until 2020. And then that's when I started my current company, that has really, you know, with kind of the goal of really evolving the training experience towards more of a coaching experience where, people are not coming in just for kind of random one-off workouts here and there. They're actually pursuing, you know, a robust coaching program that addresses their fitness, nutrition, lifestyle, behavior, kind of all of these things baked in to the formula, to give the client more tools for them to be successful. And a lot of this is just an evolution of my experience, because you realize after a certain amount of time that, you know, fitness doesn't occur in a vacuum. Nutrition doesn't occur in a vacuum. Like there's all of these other components that really have to work simultaneously, or be in the conversation, you know, simultaneously for somebody that's looking for long-term sustainable results. And so that's been the big priority, you know, now over the last 2.5 years or so is, you know, providing habit-based behavior change, that I can apply to nutrition and fitness, you know, and lifestyle. And we're doing that for a whole, you know, a wide range of goals. Mm-hmm. But it just gives the client more you know, more tools to be successful. So that's, and have continued to just pursue various aspects of that, whether it's additional health coaching, you know, opportunities. And that's something that I've gotten big into over the last year or so. Again, just helping with determining why a client is there and helping a client kind of uncover the solution themselves, you know, and just empowering them. So,
yeah, I typically see a lot of runners comment on, especially on Facebook, some of the Facebook, they say, I run because I, and so typically the idea for running is that, you know, I can eat whatever I want as long as I go out and run and, or work out or whatever. I mean, I'm typically talking to runners. Sure. And so that, so it's like what you said, it's a piecemeal approach. And so like I can have whatever diet I like as long as I work out enough. And you know, so where does that overlap? Where can I know ultra marathon runners tend to be an exception. They, if you're running that far, you really have to look at your whole lifestyle more than just you know, the casual runner. You know, like I need to lose a few pounds. So where does that overlap? The mindset to be able to say, hey, it's, you know, you can't, it's not, you know, running is not a drug, or working out or physical training is not just a pill that you take. Because I mean, that's the same kind of mentality, I think, is that, you know, if I can take this pill, I can do whatever I want. If I go work out, I can do whatever I want. So how do you help them make that mindset shift?
So I think it comes down to what's the client looking for? And by that, I mean, this is obviously through conversation, right? And that we're kind of trying to pull this out, but is the client looking for sustainable changes, right? And that could be sustainable body comp changes, that could be sustainable lifestyle changes, right? And different behaviors. Because if they are, then you have to ask the question, well, if you're using running, right, to make up for poor nutrition, what happens when you can't run? It's unsustainable on its face, right? And I think that just starting with that point can, I think, change the lens just a little bit. Not trying to convince the client necessarily, but just trying to like, I'm curious, like what are you going to do then if you can't run? And that could be for any number of reasons, you know. You have an injury, you have a car wreck, like you get sick. Because now once that's not thrown into the mix, all of a sudden the diet becomes a big problem, because there are no, you know, there are no kind of guardrails on the diet, because the running or the source of exercise were the guardrails. So I think it's really important through the consultation, the initial consultation process and the assessment process to determine what the client is really looking for. Because if they're looking for just a quick, like, I got to take off 5 pounds and I'm just going to run, like, I'm going to run my 5 pounds off and I'm not going to pay any attention to the diet. That's one mindset. It's not one that I subscribe to and that I advocate, you know, for my clients. But I think identifying that then allows us to say, hey, is this the right pursuit? And just with it being short-term in nature, that's kind of counter to what I'm providing, which is kind of long-term sustainable pieces. And when we, like, through the assessment process, we'll go through not just your fitness background, right? But what are your nutrition habits? Like, what does your nutrition look like? What does your sleep look like? You know, how's your stress management? What are your energy levels like? You know, all these different things. And I think that the more questions that I ask as a coach, the more that I think the client can realize this is not actually building me up, you know, past anything short term, right? Because you can't just continue to do it. Even if it works for a little while, you know, it doesn't work indefinitely. And I've been there before too, especially when I was younger, just thinking, I'll just go run. I'm working out really hard and I can just kind of do whatever. It's just diminishing returns, you know?
Yeah. And when you're younger, you can kind of get away with that.
Sure.
Your body.
That's a great point. Yeah. It doesn't, it quickly disappears, right? It's like turning on the light switch almost at a certain point. But it is a challenge, to your point. It's definitely a challenge. And I think the industry as a whole, I don't know that the industry does a good job of countering, you know, that. If anything, I think it's the opposite. Because you see, and not the running industry, but the, I would say the fitness industry more, really pushing the narrative of like, how many calories can you burn in the least amount of time, as many days a week as possible. And enough people see that and they think that that is what they need to do for the rest of their life. And it's like, it's not going to work. Mm-hmm. I mean, something's, you know, going to take you out of that.
Well, and they see the same thing on the nutrition side. There are people who will, they're like, I'm going to start a diet, or I'm going to go on Weight Watchers, I'm going to do this thing. And it's done independently of the rest of your lifestyle and the mindset that I'm going to do it as fast as I can.
Exactly. Go ahead.
I did that. You know, it was like, that was my approach as I was, focusing on the weight loss. What, you know, for me, the mindset shift helped when I said, I gave myself a year to do the goal. You know, I said, yes, at the end of this year is where I'm going to, this is what I'm shooting for. And it was really, for me, a shift, you know, kind of what I call the ultramarathon mindset, is that this is a long-term plan, focusing on there's a lot that goes into planning for training for ultramarathon versus, you know, running 5K or even half marathon.
Yeah. So it's funny, because I was thinking about that actually before we jumped on, just like parallels between the ultra running and different aspects of fitness and nutrition. And I think the idea of, like, for a lot of these habits, whether it's fitness, nutrition, or lifestyle, right, we're starting with an ultimate goal. That goal requires a certain set of skills. Those skills require a certain set of practices. And then those practices can be created through daily actions. So, you know, it's called the GSPA model, the goal, skill, practice, action model, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's basically a flowchart. And to your point, as you work your way down this flowchart, and you ultimately end up at that action piece, right, which is done through the consultation process and everything, that thing is going to be small, or it should be small, and it should be very easy and should be doable. But to your point, when you think about that, okay, you got one daily action. Let's say we do it for 2 weeks. Then you got another one that you stack for the next 2 weeks, another one you stack for the next 2 weeks. And then, just like in a race, those miles add up. Like, mm-hmm. as you start to get through it, and small steps or small changes done consistently over time. That's, you know, that's the name of the game. And that's the only way, or that's the recommended way that I would coach nutrition. But it is challenging, because there are a lot of 30-day diets. There are a lot of the things that are promising 2 pounds a week or 3 pounds a week, and it, you know, and so it's I think really working with the client to understand where they're coming from, and then just breaking down those wins. But yeah, just like getting to an end of a race.
You've probably heard the phrase, life isn't a sprint, it's a marathon. Whoever thought of this phrase was not a runner. Because, you know, a marathon, it sounds like a long ways to run until you actually run a marathon. Yes, a marathon is not a sprint, but running a marathon is nothing like life. But the ultramarathon, especially when you get to those distances of 100K or 100 miles, the ultramarathon, that's what life is like. For success in an ultramarathon, you have to manage three things: your energy, your thoughts, and your emotions. And for success in life, you have to manage the same three things: your energy, your thoughts, and your emotions. If your thoughts are always racing from one thing to the next, and if your emotions are constantly making you stress out, these two things will drain your energy. If you're a regular listener here, you've heard the stories from runners who talk about how their mindset can struggle, and that struggle often leads to their body following their mindset down the hole and draining their energy and leading to difficulties in finishing the race. As a coach, I help my clients develop a strong mindset. So whether your goal is to run far or live your best life or to go after your epic thing, you know, I talk about that, you know, the epic thing, the thing that you dream of doing, I can help you get started. go to ultramindsetpodcast.run, schedule a free 25-minute conversation with me. I'll help you get past your feeling of being stuck. Ultramindsetpodcast.run, schedule a free 25-minute conversation, and let me get you started toward living your best life. Yeah. Now, how did you get from, so you got out of the military, and were you doing PT in the military, and how did you then transition into say, well, I think I want to run ultramarathon?
Yeah. So I did two halves. The second one was when I was in law school, and I felt really good with those. And I was like, my uncle's a big marathoner. He's done a ton of marathons. And I felt like, okay, I hadn't done one, but I'm like, I can do a marathon. I want to do something farther than that. For a challenge, just to see how it feels, and pursued that in like 2017. That was the Mount Chia, the 50K, that they have in Alabama. Pursued that, totally screwed my training up. Just with way too many miles, not enough recovery. It was like lesson learned. Didn't even make it to the starting line.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, it was to the point where I think two months before the race, I had already pulled the plug on training, just with the way my legs felt.
Injuries?
Yeah, not anything specific, more durability, I think, related. And I had skipped some of the basic tenets that I would apply if I was, you know, if I've been competing again.
Mm-hmm. So did that experience impact your coaching, your kind of approach to coaching now?
Yeah, I think the whole sustainability model is, that's why I'm so passionate about this idea of long-term sustainable change. Because I have been challenged with so many ways from not taking that approach. I mean, physically for sure, like I've two stress fractures before the Marine Corps from not being sustainable, not happy with my training, mm-hmm. The knee surgery. I had three hernias repaired when I was in Japan in the Marine Corps. I've had some different things. All have been self-inflicted, and all have been a result of not paying attention necessarily to the amount of effort that I was putting in, and and then am I meeting it with recovery? And am I setting myself up for success by looking at all of these other lifestyle areas that we've just talked about? Mm-hmm. And do those coincide with or benefit the training that I'm putting in? The answer was no.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I've learned that lesson first person for sure. And it, and it definitely is an underlying theme for everything that I do with every client, because a lot of clients will come in and I can recognize that, right? Like because they might say something that I'm like, oh yeah, I can totally see myself saying that 5 years ago, when any one of these things would have popped up. And so it's recognizing the power of toning it down a little bit, being really strategic and tactical with your training and with the other areas of your life, and recognizing how much more you can get out of that in the long run, has made a huge difference. And then ultimately I went back, this was in 2020, I signed up for that same race again, trained a whole lot better for it. Had a really bad sprained ankle, like 2 months out again. That was in December. Went, raced, and finished the race, and was having all kinds of issues afterwards. And it was all related to that ankle sprain. We ultimately did an MRI, and I had torn my posterior tib. And so now I'm kind of getting back into running again, and have been working on that for the last 2 or 3 months. And my plan, I don't know if have you ever run the Tunnel Hill 100?
I have not. I've seen people who've done it. I think a few people from my running group have run.
Oh, really? Okay. That's what I want to sign up for here in November to do it next year.
If I remember right, if I'm trying to remember the course, is that, I think it's crushed gravel and mostly like a rail to trail.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so my thinking was, hey, that trail, the terrain itself, would be ideal for some of the earlier issues I was having with my ankle, with ankle stability and things, those roots and the rocks just really become problematic for me. And so would love, and there were a lot of those in Alabama on that 50K course, not surprisingly.
Well, I think I think race directors try to do that if they can, give you as many roots and rocks as you can, as they can put in there.
And I love it. I mean, the terrain, it's beautiful terrain, right? It's awesome being there. But it adds a whole nother, dynamic to it for sure. And I think for this next race, by controlling the terrain a little bit more, allows me to focus more on just building volume, continue to get stronger, and kind of see what happens.
Yeah, that is mine. I looked at Tunnel Hill, and now that we're talking about it, know why I reeled it out, because I never want to run rail to trail, especially 100 miles. And there's a race director that's in Nebraska who has just recently put on a 200 mile run.
Really?
And I thought that sounds doubly awful.
That's doubly, yeah.
That's right. Yeah, I did my 100, my successful 100. I did on a gravel road.
Oh, nice.
And it was, big gravel. But I'd only run probably 6 miles training on road at all that year. It had all been on trails. And so and there were plenty of hills. I mean, there's a lot of, it was billed as mostly flat. It was called the Pumpkin Holler 100.
Okay.
They said it was mostly flat. It had, I think, about 1200 feet of elevation every 10 miles. So,
okay.
Not really.
Yeah.
Very flat at all.
Yeah. Not flat in hindsight, not flat.
Yeah. But no, I wanted 50 miles in, I was looking for, can I please have some roots and rocks? Because my motion, the motion of running was the same, and I just hadn't.
Yeah.
But cause it's a whole different thing. But I applaud you. I mean, I know people who like running that, rail to trail, and it is, fairly level, and there's some good things for it too, but that's like a treadmill.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So that was a funny thing. When I'm looking at pictures, of course, it's like every picture looks the same. It's just different trees, different, different parts, different overpasses.
Yeah. And the other thing I did, about a 13 mile leg during the pandemic, my running group did a 100K. And
okay.
So I was part of the team, and I did like 13 miles. The thing that I found about rail to trail is not only just the fact that the terrain doesn't change, is that since it's rail, they're mostly long, straight sections covered by trees. And you don't seem like it was for me very much like a treadmill, because you don't seem like you're making progress. You're going in, and the scenery just doesn't change much.
Yeah. So, it will be an interesting interesting experience for sure.
It will be a mental challenge.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when are you planning on that?
So that's assuming the date stays the same. It's November 12th is what they're running this year. So my understanding is the registration will open up, after just after that completes. So.
You did a successful 50 mile just not too long ago.
So the 50K was, it was just a 50K.
The 50K. Okay. I thought I thought it was a 50. I was reading.
No. Yeah. One to 50 miles, a 50K that was in 2020.
Okay.
So then I had all the injuries and stuff and,
Okay.
Yeah. So, it's going to be, it'll be an enormous challenge. Lower body wise, I'm stronger than I've ever been. Mm-hmm. So it's, that's positive. The volume of mileage is not there yet, but, continue to build that without going overboard.
A year is a good amount of time to plan for 100 miles, the training plan. That's especially if you've got a little bit of a baseline.
Yeah.
That's a real doable, but the mileage, and that's one of those things of continuing to just build that up in a gradual way and not injure yourself in the process. I know a lot of runners tend to find an injury somewhere along the way.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the biggest, recovery is going to be, you talked about New Year's resolutions, recovery is going to be a huge, a huge priority because it has to be, you know, with everything else. And I'm on my feet all day too, you know, coaching and stuff. So,
right. That's one of the things that I think a lot of runners miss is the fact of rest and recovery, that especially in a training, you get into those days of feeling good and, you know, I can go out and the recovery is, oh, I'll go out and run a couple of miles and then you feel good and you go, it can be a very deceptive thing to run on days when you should be recovering and then run too far.
Yes. No, totally. And it's funny because I see that I've also had a bird's eye or an inside peek just in working with my own clients that I can, you know, I know that that's happening because I can see it right in their training programs as they input results and things like that. So that's a very real thing. And it does always backfire. You got to respect the rest days.
Yes. So what, in the nutrition area, what is your kind of plan for the, you know, for doing 100? And, you know, would you share that for somebody who might be thinking about doing the same kind of thing of like, yeah, let's do either 50 mile or 100 miles somewhere down the road.
Yeah.
In the training, what is it? What is your nutrition piece that you follow?
So the nutrition piece is at the kind of, at the macro level, not talking about macronutrients, but you know, the big picture level,
right? Yeah.
Calories. So ensuring that I'm getting enough calories is first priority. And that's for me, that's first priority because my days are really busy and I'm on my feet a lot and I'm coaching a lot. So it's sometimes, so when you're trying to get large number of calories, 3000 plus calories a day, like that, can sometimes be challenging, right? If you, maybe you're coaching for 3 hours and then you've got a couple calls and then you've got, you know, so that's something that I'll have to prioritize. And mainly in terms of like, what does my first meal of the day look like? What are my snacks looking like? How am I able to get really high caloric, but also nutritionally dense, you know, food options in so that I'm not just relying on, you know, high caloric options that are really highly processed, right? Like a lot of the bars and the powders and stuff like that. So that's the first piece. Recovery is the second priority, somewhat maybe nutritionally related, but that's, I could be on top of the nutrition if I'm not tackling the recovery. That's going to be, it's not a recipe for success. One of my plan for, talk about New Year's resolutions on the nutrition front, going no alcohol for next year. And that, you know, I think through the analysis, and I would encourage anybody else who's thinking about doing something like this, or anything that they find challenging, it's like, identify the low hanging fruit options. Like what can I do to boost recovery and performance? And, you know, that is relatively low barrier for me to do. Mm-hmm. Removing alcohol is one piece, of the nutrition profile. Making sure that I'm hydrating, but also focusing on electrolytes. So making sure that I'm not just pounding, you know, 100 ounces of water every day, that it's, you know, paying attention to getting in, you know, sodium, potassium, magnesium, all that stuff. And what do I need to help me do that? What supplements can best help me do that? And then it's going to be, you know, a high carbohydrate diet. So, probably less fat overall. And specifically for carbohydrates, like a lot of my go-tos are, you know, just like brown rice, the quinoa, like, sweet potatoes or regular potatoes, whole grain pasta. And so those are the big priorities on, for sure, on training days, or days where I'm burning a lot of calories, and then also making sure that I'm getting like, you know, something green, preferably multiple things, but something green on my plate, you know, with lunch and dinner, and then making some increases to fruit, and nothing crazy, but just making sure that I'm having some every day. I have previously tracked my macros, tracked all my stuff in my Fitness Pal. If I have a specific need for it, like if I'm trying to figure something out, like how many calories am I taking in, or am I not taking in enough protein? Maybe I think that I am. I'll track it for a little bit, but for the most part, I'm sticking to like big picture concepts like that. And then just seeing how am I feeling with my, you know, with my training, and how am I feeling not only while I'm training, but then the next day, you know, in the next morning when I wake up. And if I'm feeling sore and lower energy and stuff, then I know I need to change whatever I did yesterday. Like I need to change the portions a little bit. And then that comes back to tracking. If I'm not able to just, kind of tinker with that by, okay, let's add some more carbs at lunch. Let's add, you know, then I will track it and get some better data so I can be a little bit more pinpointed with it. But to answer your question, my biggest obstacle probably when we talk about performance historically has been not enough calories, just a burn. I burn a ton. And, you know, if you're going to pursue something really physically challenging, those, and you're under consuming, that catches up with you at a certain point, typically sooner than later. And then I'll start having all kinds of other problems.
So for somebody who's looking to kind of lose weight, is there possible to under eat?
Yeah.
And end up stymieing your success?
Yeah. And it definitely is. And I think that's the case for a lot of people. Unfortunately, because of like the narratives that we were talking about earlier, right, that are in the fitness or nutrition space, that you see a lot, that overemphasize calorie restriction, which is a legitimate part of losing weight, but it's taken to the extreme. So they're talking about caloric restriction, you know, of 1,000 calories a day or 1,200 calories a day, or less, you know, for people that are doing, maybe if they're doing some kind of detox or something like that. And, you know, I think the big takeaway is, because it's not so much that there's a right way and a wrong way to do it, because everybody is different. And so what works for one person is not necessarily going to work for you, and vice versa. But I think that a lot of people kind of bypass asking themselves the tough questions necessarily. So if you want to try this low calorie, you know, diet because you're trying to lose 5-10 pounds and it worked for your friend, cool, go for it. But when it stops working, ask yourself, you know, just be honest with yourself, be like, this is not working. Maybe I need to pursue something else, or pursue a different strategy. And I think that a lot of people don't necessarily do that, and that creates more problems because they continue to try the same thing and it's not working, right? And you can get a certain bump in your weight loss by initially going really low, or thinking that you're going to really cut carbs to really low levels or whatever it is. But you know, after your body adjusts to whatever you're doing to it, if it's not working anymore, it's probably not right sustainable in some form or fashion. And I think that what I found with a lot of folks is that if we can approach this again with the goal, skill, practice, action kind of model, you know, if the skill is trying to, you know, eat more quality nutrition, and the practice is, you know, eating more protein, let's say, and the daily action that we're focused on just, you know, just for this 2-week period is, you know, eating an extra palm of protein at lunch, like something really basic like that. And then we do that across the board. A lot of times people, their body composition will change and they'll lose weight, good weight. So it's body fat, they're not losing muscle mass, but they're eating more than they have in a long time. And they're shocked that their body comp is responding the way it is, because maybe they're eating 400, 500, 600 calories more than they were previously. But they were so undernourished in a lot of ways that your metabolism is just not, it stops working with you, like it normally should, you know? Mm-hmm.
So you'd mentioned cutting out alcohol and we trail runners, especially.
Yeah. I know what you're going to say. Yeah.
I mean, we have Fireball oftentimes at the aid stations.
I've seen it. If I wasn't struggling so much on that last run, I might have partaken.
And I know that's kind of part of the culture. And then, I think once a quarter, it's been a while since we did it. It should be coming up again. We have competitors in the beer mile. Yeah. I can't drink that much. I mean, I can't do four beers in, whatever time it takes me to run a mile. It's just, can't.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of us like to drink. Is there a point at which, you said you're cutting alcohol and you're cutting it all out. Is there a level of acceptable, to be able to perform? I consider myself a moderate drinker. I like the taste of various kinds of alcohol, but I like I said, I can't do more than I do. If I drink, it's a beer, or a glass of wine. I don't ever drink very much. So is that is there a level at which you can kind of keep that equilibrium?
Yeah, I think there definitely is. And I think it's different for everybody. So yeah, I'm definitely not saying you have to, a person has to cut out alcohol, right, to do something like this. Because I love, in fact, when I got out of the military, so it was the two things that I was driven, that I was drawn to. One was I want to be in the fitness space and be mentoring and working with other people one-on-one. But the other option was, I talked to my brother. I'm like, hey, we should start a brewery.
Yeah.
I think it's very, it's situational, and it's again, kind of going back to what I was saying on the nutrition front of, just empowering yourself to ask, is this working for me? And if it's working for you, great. Like, no worries. If you find that it is, if you ask yourself that question and you find some negative answers creeping up in terms of, secondary effects, right? Or like third order effects of it, like it's keeping me from doing X, Y, and Z, and I really want to do X, Y, and Z. Then you find a way to moderate it. And I think there's no right answer. I think for me, I know how busy I am and know how I want to and will need to maximize every opportunity to get my body recovery and the sleep and everything it needs, especially because I am I've done this for a long time, but as far as just fitness in general and being physically active, but I'm still also, I gotta make sure that the legs are not only recovering, but also growing, and I'm able to continue to do all of these things. So I kind of looked at it like, and this is something I talk about with my clients, like approach goals or avoidance goals. And I kind of look at this as an approach goal, meaning I want to, seek out and approach better recovery, better sleep, better performance, better runs, all of that stuff. And so that's the reason that I'm cutting it out as opposed to like an avoidance goal where I'm avoiding this because I don't want it. I think that's at least how I look at it. And I like looking at things like that, because you can also, if you're just trying to avoid something, it's like you're just fighting with your willpower. Yeah, like, because you want something, but there's no real, like, you're just trying to avoid it because you're supposed to, or because you think you're supposed to. But if you're approaching something, if you're kind of discontinuing one thing because you're approaching something else that you need or want, then it becomes kind of a different perspective. And I think also it keeps me disciplined on the weekends, so that, there's continuity from week to week with training. Not that it wouldn't be there otherwise, but you know, I think just a way to set me up for success for next step, really.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. You talk about trying to avoid something that is in the mindset category. And, you know, psychologists have said this as well, is that when you try to resist something, if it's an emotional thing and you're trying to resist, you know, not do something, you actually give that more power, and that your resistance will make that stronger. I mean, I've heard it, you know, martial artists will say that too, that the most effective type of, you know, martial arts are the ones where they're using the person's momentum instead of trying to oppose the force of you redirect it and work with it, because you opposing a force actually makes it stronger.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. I mean, think about it for trying to avoid sugar or something that. Yeah, if you're I just have to stop eating X, Y, and Z. If that's the extent of the plan, that's a tough, I mean, good on you, but it's a tough plan, right? Because it doesn't provide any outside forces, any help,
right? And you know, the addiction to sugar is, I mean, that's a physical, psychological, emotional. I mean, there's all those components in there that I've heard people compare it to regular drugs. I mean,
it hits the dopamine.
And I know there's a lot of people who I've talked to and that I've known that have completely given up alcohol. And they says, I can't, you know, I'm not going to do that. And I can identify, because I don't have that with alcohol, but you know, mine was reading books, it was fiction. And I would get into, it's like, oh yeah, people say that's not a big deal. I mean, but for me, it was a similar type of draw. It was an emotional thing to get caught up in the story, just from my personality. Yeah. And, you know, I'd get into a series that was 20 books long and I'd be putting off stuff that I knew that I should be doing. And I mean, it did interfere with my productivity and the things that I wanted to do. And, you know, as people say, it's not that big a deal, but for me, it was, and I've had to limit my, making the decision and say, you know, I want something different for my life. And it's what I, how do you spend your time? I can identify with the mindset and those issues for people who say, I can't stop at one drink. It's like, well, I can't stop at one book if there's another one in the series, you know.
right. Yeah, no, all of us, right? We're constantly doing a cost benefit analysis with everything, you know. If the benefit outweighs the cost, then you're probably going to take the benefit. But if the cost is overwhelming and you feel like you're just white knuckling it and stuff, then it's probably not going to work.
We're notorious though about not being able to really evaluate those things, because we'll take the benefit, the immediate benefit over, you know, and not really look at the long-term cost. You know, again, talking about the ultramarathon mindset, you've got to plan for the long haul.
That's such a, there's so many carryovers, right? And one of the things I talk about a lot is, avoiding the kind of instant gratification mentality, right? And really trying to seek out this idea of delayed gratification. And obviously it's a continuum, right? But if you are going to take on anything worth substance, whether it be a really long race like an ultra or a significant amount of weight loss, or lifestyle changes, you know, pursuing that delayed gratification and getting closer and closer, it's very hard to do, but that's how it's done. I mean, that's how anything is of value is accomplished, at least in my opinion. I think for a lot of things, it could be a huge benefit there.
Yeah, and kind of what you said, the small steps, that's an important aspect of it. Too much, that's what an ultramarathon is a series of small steps. And I think that's so much of life. And you're kind of teaching that to your clients too. Look at the whole.
Yeah. It's challenging. You know, I mean, I think we would all say, right, like Eric, I think we'd all say there's probably a number of decisions we do in our personal life on a day-to-day basis where we have to, it doesn't come natural, right? We all, we,
right.
We want everything instantaneously, and the social tools and things at our disposal only, and that continue to come out, right, are only furthering that. So yeah, it's a challenge.
Yes. Well, Ben, thank you so much for spending time here. Tell us, tell people how they can get a hold of you. What's the best way to contact you?
Sure. They can find me on Instagram at Coach Ben Real, and they can go to the website. It's c1fn.com.
C1fn.com. Okay.
You got
thanks.
It.
And, yeah. And I'll have those links on the show notes.
That's great. Thanks so much for having me, Eric. I appreciate
it. Before you go, I have what I call the bridge questions.
Who approaches the bridge of death must answer me these questions three. The other side he see.
Ask me the questions, bridge keeper. I'm not afraid.
So first question is, what is your must-have piece of gear or equipment?
Must-have piece of gear, or, piece equipment? Of gear
or equipment.
On a race?
Just in your training. Whether it's race or training, I'll leave that to you to decide.
So the first thing that popped into my head was gummy bears. Gummy bears for a race.
No, I have not. I take that back. I have seen somebody on Instagram who does that. Tell me about gummy bears.
I would do this. I did this in the Marine Corps when we'd be on long road marches, and I'd have some gummy bears in my cargo pocket, but I used them on the 50K, and they were a huge help. I just packed my mouth with gummy bears and just kind of slowly eat them from aid station to aid station. Or if I was feeling like I was kind of bonking a little bit, those were a great go-to. Might not have been the answer you were looking for, but that's the first thing that popped into my head.
No, you've got me thinking of Honey Stinger has something similar to gummy bears. But of course, you know, they have the Honey Stinger brand on them. And I'm like, gummy bears would be probably a
they're a great tool while you're out there. And I have another client that she's a big hiker. She goes on all kinds of crazy excursions and stuff, and suggested that to her, and it was like life changing, you know, when she started using those and being out on the trail. So
they would be a quick and a great, I mean, because so many things like get soft and mushy, and I mean, yeah. I can see a lot of advantages to the gummy bears, and it's like nothing that I normally keep around the house. So it's like, okay,
that's the thing. I never eat gummy. I couldn't tell you the last time I've eaten gummy bears. It was the race. That was the last time that I'd have them. But they're definitely a go-to. Throw in the bag when.
Yeah. So would you do it on training and long runs? Is that something you'd
for actual training? Training, I'll stick to like the gels and what was the other stuff that I was doing? Tailwind, stuff like that. I'll save like the good stuff, you know, I'll save those for an actual race. And then it's even more enjoyable than, and I haven't really gotten used to it. And I'm like really looking forward to it and stuff. So I haven't worn it out, you know, over training.
Yeah. Yeah. See, I had tried my go-to was peanut M&Ms, and I was doing that.
I'm also a fan of those.
Those had a tendency to break down, and I got to a point where it just didn't taste good. So
Anyway,
second question: what is the weirdest thing you've ever seen out in your? And I'll go clear back military. When you've been out running, what's the weirdest thing you've ever seen?
Weirdest thing I've ever seen. That is a great question. I'm sure that there have been, I'm trying to think even of my time, like in Miami, I'm sure I saw some crazy stuff there. Honestly, not too long ago, this past year, I'm in town, Atlanta. And I was on the Freedom Path for anybody that's in Atlanta. They'll know what I'm talking about. Well, I was running down the path. It's concrete, like a wide sidewalk, basically. Well, I was just running, and there was a whole bunch of like garbage and some of it trash, some of it like metal objects. I don't know. It was just a whole bunch of random stuff. And this guy was kind of organizing it. He was not on this planet. And was, you know, kind of approached me to ask me, like, what do you think about this? Is this organized enough?
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, yeah, looks great, man. Like, looking good. And then he kind of went back to his thing. That's the weirdest thing. I did not expect to see that. Fortunately, nothing else pops out in my head. I guess maybe I need to spice up my running routes a little bit more, maybe.
Well, the thing about the weird things, the weird stuff, it just happens at random. I mean, you never know when it's going to pop out. Yeah.
So it's bizarre.
Yeah. Third question is, what is a word or phrase that sums up your philosophy?
I would say sustainable.
Sustainable. I like that.
But, you know, I would caveat that and say striving for sustainable. Mm-hmm. Because it doesn't, you know, it's not like an end state that you just reach and then it's like, but that's what I'm striving for, not only with my clients but also with myself and everything that I'm doing. And you get wins and losses, but that's definitely the direction. So,
yeah, and there's ups and downs, and there are times when you realize that something isn't sustainable, and you adjust.
Yeah,
you adjust as you go along.
Yeah, totally. But yeah, that sums it up pretty good.
Well, thank you a lot, Ben. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I appreciate you, Eric. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Ultra Marathon Mindset Podcast. I do enjoy being able to spend time with you here each week. I appreciate you taking the time to listen. The show notes for this episode and others are at ultramindsetpodcast.run. You can find this week's guest there. More information, links to their social media and website. There's also a podcast player there if you want to share this episode with somebody who does not normally listen to podcasts and doesn't have a podcast player on their phone. You can also find links there for my Amazon affiliate link, Crush Your Goals course, a short course I made to help you get your goals in order. Also, you can schedule a chat with me. My online calendar is there. All of these links are at the sidebar if you're on a laptop, or you have to scroll clear to the bottom if you are on a phone. If you did enjoy this episode and you do not know somebody who might like it, take it just a minute, send them a link so they can listen. Remember that an ultramarathon mindset is about more than just running. You need a strong mindset for success no matter what your goal in life. And developing a strong mindset is a skill you can improve. Thank you again for listening. I'll see you next time.